run is probably something akin to a colporteur, the original colporteur, if you ask me. In our little world of the arts of the book and the book arts, Ron was the trailblazer. He's the man that was out there on the road with a bag of books on his back, as I understand his grandfather was before him. Ron, in 1969, or possibly 68, depending on which way you look at the universe, first came to the United States and started visiting special collections libraries. And it was a very clever move. And since then, we have all walked his path. Those of us who sell things, those of us who make books, and those of us who rely upon the selling of those books ourselves as a colporteur walking the aisles. Well, so that's to give you an idea of the strength of the man in our community. Ron formed the Circle Press in 1967 as both a part of the tradition and very much a breaker of the tradition. The stages of his life are marked not only by the individual natures of those of the books and the prints that he has published, but also by the differing character of the decades through which the press has passed. Ron's collaborations, when Ron is descriptive, on his website about the Circle Press, I mean, Ron himself very does not appear so much as his collaboration, as a we. It's always a group of people working. And it was suggested to support his vision of a group of like-minded persons who, working over time, have come to include over 100 artists. He has had the confidence to be very unfashionably Catholic in his choice of writers and artists, and he has invited people from various continents to work with him as well. And now that I'm looking at this lengthy introductory piece that I've written about Ron, I think I'm going to quit because, you know, actually his websites will say it much better than I. And the man, Ron King, is a great storyteller, and so I want to introduce Ron and let him tell us the story. And as he said to me earlier this evening, he says, "This is my first one-man show."
Not true. Welcome, Ron King.
See, can you all hear me?
Yeah.
All right. Where's that picture? Have all my pictures disappeared?
No.
There it is. Do any of you recognize that? Do any of you know where that is? Other than people who know me very closely. That is actually one of the most beautiful bays in the world. It's Rio de Janeiro, which was, when I lived there, the capital of Brazil. Since then, Niemeyer has built a new capital in the middle of Brazil, and the people who lived there used to fly there and back rather than miss out on this most wonderful bay with all its beaches and gorgeous girls on Copacabana, which you've probably heard of. And I like to think that those two little figures are myself and a friend about to dive off and swim to the island in the middle of the bay, because that is where I lived. That is where I had most of the influences which have made me play with scissors and paper and card and make the books which I've made. I lived in Brazil for quite a few years. But before that, let me thank Peter and Susan, who with Karen brought me over here. They persuaded me to join the gathering. Most of you more qualified than myself to give a good talk on printing. But what made me hesitate and nearly refuse to come was that Peter wanted me to prepare a paper for the purpose of publishing. Now, I am no good at writing at all. And it took a lot of persuasion, I can tell you. Because usually when I give these talks, I talk off the cuff. And I have a whole lot of books to show, and here I have none. So, with Karen's help, I punctuated what I wanted to say with a whole lot of pictures, so that mainly I can do this talk off the cuff. But when I get kind of nervous and in a panic, I can refer to these bits of paper. Anyhow, that's Brazil, and let's get on with it, because I know there's a time limit on this, and I want to make it so you don't have to ask me any questions at all. Because if you ask me questions, I'm sure I won't be able to answer. First of all, I want to say, that's me, ready. That's me, ready for carnival. My life was carnival, masks, kites, balloons, all made with paper, flour and water, glue, bamboo, you name it, we had it. Singing, arguing, making a lot of noise, and always frantic, frantically making things. I'm still frantic. In everything I do, I couldn't possibly be an etcher, because etching demands that wonderful state of slow and careful preparation and printing. I'm a screen printer. Anyhow, let's go on. My life in Brazil is very much illustrated by this rather wonderful man who was one of the first printmakers on the Rio scene. I've forgotten his name at the moment, but I'll remember it in a way. But there was my dog, always being chased by the dog catchers who were going to turn him into soap. His name was Leskoček, Axel Leskoček, an Austrian who went to Brazil, made a book which was never printed, but which I saw all the proofs in the Brazilian Cultural Center in Washington and undertook to print into a small book. There's also that wonderful scene at the bottom of the vultures eating a floating horse in the middle of the bay, which I remember very well. I still own the original woodcut for that. From Brazil, at the age of 13, at the end of the war, I was sent to England to go to a barracks of a boarding school by my English father. I come from a very mixed background. My mother was a Sephardic Jew, born in Constantinople, chased across the Mediterranean, landed up in Brazil, and somehow got married to this Englishman who worked for a bank. Half English, half Irish. And from that school, this barracks of a boarding school in England, which I was sent to at the age of 13, beaten every other day, like most boarding schools at that time, I went to art school in Chelsea School of Art in London. And I showed this, because I had no interest in printing at all. And then this is one of those incredible contradictions. I had no interest in printing at all, yet in my first year at art school, between 19 and 20, we were sent out to do a perspective drawing in some sort of workshop. And I ended up in a basement printing workshop in the Fulham Road in London, doing this drawing of these Arab presses. I was still very influenced by what was sometimes used at that time and pummeled into us, the golden section. So you can see half the drawing is in a square, the other half is in the other bit. And from that rather wonderful situation, Here is a carry-on from my carnival days in Brazil. Masks for the Chelsea Arts Ball, and all the kids that were there to be liberated from their horrendous backgrounds into becoming creative people. My work at that time was basically fine art. I was to be a painter. That was my aspiration. And I still am basically an artist who makes books rather than a book artist. I always have used my fine art background to influence what I have done in one way or another. I emigrated to Canada with my young wife, who is here, and we've been married since 1955. She was also a student at Chelsea School of Art, and landed up in Canada to avoid two military services, one which would not accept the other, Brazilian and British. And from window dressing to all sorts of other things, I ended up being an assistant art director in a Canadian magazine, and finally art director. And these are two of the photographs that I took for the covers of Homes and Gardens. I show these things because they are important in my background. They're important, and they're important to everyone who is studying in the creative field. It seems to me that anything you do will in the end be of use to what you're going to implement in your art. And photography came quite early. On my return to England for my one-man show, I was short of money, and I did quite a lot of commercial illustration. These are three illustrations for an advertising firm in London that wanted to pull in their clients. So they were expert fishers. Moby Dick on the bottom left, Living Silver, another novel on the right at the bottom, and at the top, Cork on the Water, a thriller. All experts at fishing. Now, the reason I show this is because it's straight illustration. And the last book, which I will show you a kind of full circle, where having done all the experiments and jiggery-pokery, which I did with my printing, I ended up doing something which was rather similar, black and white illustration, but with a purpose. Here's one of my very first prints. I had never done printmaking at art school. The facilities were pretty terrible. I had a little session of lithography for a while, but I wasn't interested in printing. When I got back to England, I ran out of money, had to teach at an art school, which had a wonderful printmaking department, and a guy who used to do silkscreen reproductions of cave paintings, and he was leaving the art school and sold me all his silkscreen equipment for £12, that's about $18, and I started messing around doing monoprints. From monoprints, I made more and more prints, and ended up seeing those wonderful books in the Victoria and Albert Museum, the Matisse, Jazz, A Toute Épreuve by Miro, and decided that my way with my silk screening was to go towards books. This is the very first book I produced. Paper stencils, 48 colors, 140 books, 75 separate prints, all done through paper stencils. The letterpress was done by a local man who had a Heidelberg. "I can't get your sheets through there," he said to me. He folded them in half and he put them through this wonderful cylinder Heidelberg. So all I had to do was to take those sheets back home and print them in the top bedroom, and later in the background of our house I built a studio, and these are some of the images I produced. They were paper stencil images based on African masks and heraldry, and I did 14 pilgrims in the prologue to the Chaucer Canterbury Tales. This is my very first book. The publishers who were meant to take this over failed me, and that's what brought me over to the States. Now, one of the things I want to impress on you is that without the generosity, the reception, the incredible kind of cooperation that I got in the United States, I would never have been able to run the press. Nothing happened very much in England. "Well, who are you producing this kind of thing? Who do you think you are? Where were you trained? Who sent you here?" That was what the kind of reception I got in English museums and libraries. So I packed up, came over to the States, and risked myself, even with people like Eleanor Garvey and Peter Hofer at the Houghton, and they were all wonderful. After my first trip, I returned and formed Circle Press. I said, "This is great. Come on, make books." And a friend of mine, Ian Tyson, who formed his own press, joined me and became, even though he was younger than myself, my mentor in terms of poetry and other things. These are some of the other images, and I'll run through them quite quickly. My second book, The Song of Solomon, still, I had no letterpress of my own. I relied on a printer to do the letterpress which I had laid out. I had a good feeling for typography by then, which I picked up on that magazine in Canada. The silk screen came from the show department that did show cards in the first store that I worked in, where I did some window dressing. Here's another page from the Song of Solomon. And here is an example of the first book I actually letterpressed. I had trouble with my printers because I kept invading the shop floor and telling them that I wanted more impression. I don't know if you know, but the unions in England at that time were incredibly strong. And they banished me from the floor of the print shop. "Get out or we go on strike." That's very good. That's going to happen again soon. They didn't want me on. And the owner of the printing establishment decided that I was causing too much trouble. And he offered me a small storeroom at the other end of the town, as well as far away as possible, please. And I will actually give you some furniture and help you get some type, but please get the hell out of here. And I bought a great big proofing press called an Asburn proofing press, second hand, which could print up to 30-20. And one of the compositors at that printing house came over to help me learn how to set type. And with him, I set the whole of Macbeth in 14-point planting. Here are a couple of the images from that book. And somewhere along the line, I picked up an etching press as well. I've got my Brazilian bandit mask on there. Actually, I'm going to do an installation quite soon, which includes about 20 figures with beaten masks, bandits, and everyone that comes to the exhibition will have to wear a mask just like that. Let's go on. Right, having come over to the States and got things going, it became a sort of two-year habit. Come over, show your new stuff, go around, find places which you've never been to before. Seek out Kalamazoo, Chattanooga, all those places which I'd heard of before in between times. And the generosity continued. Never did I go to a library where some librarian didn't say, "Hey, why don't you go and see so-and-so or so-and-so? He collects. Why don't you go and see Lessing Rosenwald? My gosh, Lessing Rosenwald in the Alverthorpe Museum outside Philadelphia, one of the greatest collectors in the world. Me? Harold Joachim at the Chicago Institute of Art? One of the greatest Rembrandt and experts in the world." All those people were hospitable in the end. And there was Pinocchio, Random House book in New York, which I bought for my kids. Hey, I'm getting kind of sick of doing this illustration stuff with type on the side. Why don't I do a pop-up book? So, this is where the collaboration started, and this is where printing began to mean something to me. Printing, not just letterpress, but printing anyway that would express an idea in the best way to put it across. Bluebeard's Castle, Bartok's Opera. Now, recently, a guy called Matthew Sperling wrote a book and complained about the fact, it wasn't a book, it was a paper from Oxford, and complained about the fact that in all the collaborations which I had made with this particular poet had not been published, text and image together. He said the poetry didn't mean a thing without the illustrations. And the illustrations were basically kind of starved without the words. And this is true of most of the books that we do. We show and people don't read the text. And sometimes people read the text without showing how they were illustrated. And the basis and the strength of collaboration come from that combination of the two. And the basis of a good collaboration is where one can not do without the other. So, I'm going to try to see you through the first of my collaborations, which was, I decided to be the Bartok Opera of Duke Bluebeard's Castle, which has this wonderful, I don't know if you know the opera, but there are only two voices in it. And in it, Bluebeard takes back his latest lover, Judith, to the castle. And in the opera, a darkened stage with a stairway in the middle comes down and lets them down into a stage set which has seven doors. What a wonderful idea. I got a fine feeling that I should have worked in theatre, because most of these books are theatre. And that's why I like taking them around. I like taking them around because I also enjoy showing them, explaining them, but letting people understand that really what they're doing is seeing them in their own minds, not just in what I'm presenting them. And Bluebeard was just right. Let me find the words for it. I was helped by a woman who was one of the biggest promoters of printmaking in England, called Pat Gilmore, to research the idea of Bartok's opera. She gave me a lot of text on it, and I'm going to lay out that book on my table when I go back so that some of you can see it. It's well out of print. It's a small book, but it's extremely important in my career. It's extremely important because I decided from then on that any book I did would either be with the poet Roy Fisher, who I used for this, or not at all, because he was so empathetic to what I did, and I was to his writing as well. We seem to have gone out. Does that mean anything? Do I hit home? Sorry.
Where's Jonathan? Ah. Yeah. Okay, good.
Right. She saves me always. I couldn't do without Karen, and she helped me make this. This is the entrance to the castle. I have seen you through it. Can I go back on it at all or not? No.
You'll get to the middle of it.
There's the beginning. Beyond me, the common daylight divides. Can I hit it now?
The one to the right.
Yeah. And there's a lattice work of paper there. I had all the kids and neighbors helping me put this together on the kitchen table. And the whole book is silkscreened from end to end. I'm getting a bit confused here. And the next page, which was the castle, that was the entrance, the portcullis, the entrance to the book. Here is the castle itself. This was the most difficult pop-up to devise because, as you probably know, pop-ups have to be symmetrical. And you try and make a symmetrical... It won't go back to the castle, will it?
It will. It will. It's the right one. Right.
Yeah. Oh. We've gone too far. Come back. Yeah. There. Think of seven and try and make a symmetry of it. If you put two fours and let them join the central square, it'll make a seven. And that folds beautifully. So, here we go. The light of the sky has come from the world to be packed 1 to 7 for a journey. And then we enter all the wonderful secret doors. Number one, I used a computer memory image which I got out of Scientific American. The torture chamber. The instruments, he called it. Now, it's very interesting. Here we have an opera with two people singing at each other, a grand love debate. We couldn't do that. We couldn't have little figures. I mean, it would be kind of corny, wouldn't it? So what we decided to do was to make the rooms, the secret chambers, become the important part of the whole book. So, this was the instruments, the first door, the torture chamber. Man conceived us. We work almost with perfection, and we feel no pain. Second door. Here we have the armory. I designed it, I
I didn't touch that. Come back. Here we have the armory. Those are wire bars which come out. You'll be able to see it if you want to. Be careful, though. It's my last one. Provide that their mouths may bleed into cinders, with bronze and steel provide. The treasure house. What the sun touches shines on, forever dead. The dead images of the sun, wonderful. The garden. This is a flower pop-up. This was designed in 1971, eh? Whose is the body you remember in yourself? And then Bluebeard turns to Judith and he says, "Will you stay with me? Here is my kingdom. You can have all of it. It's the land, the light, the rain, the eye, the rainbow. Horizons form, random and inevitable, as rainbows over bright fields of change." Judith says, "No, you've got to open up those two last doors." He says, "Oh, they're forbidden. You can't go in there." She says, "Go on, open them up." And he does, regrettably, open up, and there's the Lake of Tears. Now, it's very interesting that at the beginning of the opera, a bard comes on and says, "Hey, you want to know what this is all about? Well, it's what happens all over the world. On this stage, it happens. But the important thing is what happens in the stage of your mind." And so, in the stage of my mind, this is Bluebeard with his conscience. Bluebeard, who had apparently killed all his previous wives. This was his memory, going back, and I made it with two little mirrors so that anyone looking at the book could kind of look and think what it was all about. So this was the one before last door. The Lake of Tears. Day has turned to a silver mirror whose dead extent the weeping eyes could never see. And then the last door. She says, "Open that one." He says, "No. You open that one and we're finished." She says, "If you don't open that one, we're finished." And she's thinking all the time, "I know this reputation, but I've got to face it." And they open it, and instead of the horrors which she expects, out come the most beautiful women dressed in wonderful clothes, three of them. And he introduces them as Dawn, Noon, Twilight. And then they gather round her and dress her in black. And she becomes Night. And that is the end of the opera. So, that was my first collaboration, and one which I was to carry through on 9 other books. Anyone want to ask me anything about that at the moment? Because I feel sometimes that going through something like this, you'll forget something that you wanted to ask. Okay, let's go through. Next one, a more flippant approach, but one which has a sort of gravity to it. We lost our first son around this time, and one of the things he had said to me on seeing one of Roy's very early manuscripts, which was a wonderful text about the mad knitters of Dent. In the north of England, there were people who bred sheep, spun the wool, and knitted like mad. They were called the demon knitters of Dent. They not only knitted, but they even competed. And if they were going to get together and knit together, they would say, "Neighbors, we'll not part tonight." And Roy had written a rather lovely kind of ballad, and this is the ballad. Now, because it was about knitting, I went the whole hog. I did a whole lot of research and found out about the songs they sang and the things they did other than just knit. And I built them into images which are all made up of knitted objects. I haven't got that here. It's a very large portfolio. But I did it in the memory of my son and his brother and sister. Here's the title page. I actually got a wonderful German lady who's married to a friend of mine in England called Astrid Thurnival to knit that first page you saw. And then I photographed it and put it on silk screen onto the title page. Here are the stanzas. They are done in symbolic colors for the days of the week. And those were knitted as well. But they're not knitted there. They are reproductions, obviously, in silk screen. The basic color underneath, still using paper stencil for that, but having learned how to use a photo stencil on my screen. And letterpress, very large plantain. I had a rather wonderful session here with my poet because we spelt woolen with only one L, which is the American spelling. I had an assistant who came from the States, who is now head of the bookmaking department at Camberwell School of Art. She had been sent to me by Claire Van Fleet of the Jonas Press, and she helped me set that page, and she had spelt woolen with one L. But Roy, being Roy, said, "Oh, so what? Make it with one L." And so we didn't have to print it all over again. Here are some of the images. They're all made out of knitted objects. And this book was primarily aimed at children, but it has quite a lot of history in it. And I used the Anglo-Saxon counting, Yan, Tan, Tethera, Methera, Pimp, which they use not only for counting their stitches, but for counting the sheep on the hillside. The landscape, and a German typographical system used for knitting in the background there. And each of these prints relating to one of those stanzas that you saw before. This is Giantess Appleyard with all the knitting things in her head. And this is the smoke going out of the chimneys at the end while they knitted, raced to see who could knit most in the evening. Right, let's move on. I tend to go from color to white if I can. And having again done a poem with Roy, which was from A to Z, and I won't read it to it because we probably haven't got time, or have we? No. I did the ABC down the gutter of this, and his poem starts with A, second line B, and so on. And having seen this, he said, why don't you do the whole of the alphabet? And that's how the alphabet came to being. It's the only grant that I ever received. All the people who I helped would come to the press and go out and get grants. And I was getting kind of envious of this. Why can't I get a grant? And I, you get a grant? You've been printing with me. I did your first book. I helped you do this. I can't get a grant. How come? They all said, because you always ask for a grant for the press as a whole. They're not interested in that. Give them a project you're going to do of your own. Anyhow, I'm on the board. I'll make sure you get it. That's the truth. That was a guy called Ian Mortimer who has become a really good letterpress printer in England now. But I did his first book with my worn-out 14-point from Macbeth. And then I told him to go off and form his own press. And I said, I'm sure you can print better than that. So that was the first alphabet. And Roy did a text for the second alphabet book, which was done at the same time, signed, limited, sold for more money, and now very much out of print. And here's the poster. The poster's 30 by 20 with the whole of the alphabet on, and it's my most successful piece. I've been selling it at the Tate Gallery since 1985, and it still sells 50 to 100 a year. Rolls up, stuck down one side, see it on my website, order it anytime you like. And many years later, in fact, last year, I designed the lowercase. The lowercase comes without that text, but a friend of mine who works in the British Library, I commissioned to do a rather lovely poem, a love poem. So if you guys need something for Valentine's Day, hurry to Vamp and Tramp, because I've already run out of them. Punch and Judy was the next big book that I did with Roy. And actually, to be quite honest, is my favorite. I am a narrative artist. And I like something which starts and ends quite logically. And I don't know whether Punch and Judy as a trad-